Hello and welcome to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers and with me this week, as ever, we have Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And joining us again, extra special guest, Inaya Follerin-Iman.
Hi.
Coming up on today's show, we'll be talking about the return of Donald Trump, the war in Ukraine, Baby 8 Billion and Nicola Sturgeon's trans crusade. So Donald Trump is back. Tom, are you on the Trump train? Are you excited about the return of, it's not just MAGA now, it's Make America Great and Glorious.
Glorious, I guess. What was that, MAGAG or something? I don't know. You do get the feeling, you know, looking at that big event at Florida, that he is sort of yesterday's man, really. And I don't mean that to be sort of dismissive. What I mean that is to say that the idea that populism in America lives or dies whether or not Trump is running, I think, has always been a bit of a nonsense. And I think we're at the point where essentially the Trump train, such as it is just, it's just run out of steam, if to stretch the metaphor. And there's obvious reasons for that. You know, I think there has been a sort of tendency on the part of sort of commentators, as we were talking about, to sort of like act as if the two are sort of joined together, that the decision of people back in 2016 to kind of hit out of the establishment, so on and so forth, that this is basically just a Trump thing. As soon as Trump is defeated, it will go away. So there's kind of interest on both sides in sort of perpetuating that particular myth. But at the same time, it's quite clear that the public's patience with him has run out, even though a lot of those feelings of being ignored by the establishment, of the establishment kind of pushing mad ideologies down their throats, has only intensified under Joe Biden. They just don't see Trump as the figure to push that through. You see that it's like 65% of Americans don't even want him to run again, which is about the same as people who don't actually want Joe Biden to run again. And I think particularly after all of the stop the steal madness towards the end of his presidency, any claim he might once have had to being that sort of like tribune for democratic revolt was just completely eviscerated. He was always a slightly odd proposition. That was the point in which the wheels really fell off. And I think in a way the polls and everything else speak for themselves insofar as he's not going to be the person who pushes this forward. He was a sort of blunt instrument that was used to hit back at the establishment, but there were problems with that project from the off. And I think those are just even more glaring now that he's announcing again, really.
Yeah, and I mean, do you see it that way, that kind of maybe in 2016 there could have been something positive about this reaction, but now it's just got a bit weird? January the 6th, election denial, as you suggested, Tom, some of the odd candidates he picked for the midterms.
Yeah. No, I think, as Tom kind of said, I think many of the issues that gave rise to Trump in many ways still exist. You know, the contemptuous attitude towards huge swathes of the American population. As Tom said, again, you know, many of these identity-based ideologies anti-democratically being pushed to the majority of the population, and you know, a demonization of those who disagree. And it was those conditions and the kind of inability to find a vehicle to express those frustrations which gave rise to Trump. And I guess, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, in that context, it almost seemed that there was only someone like Trump could have really, you know, risen, because the way that the establishment at that time were so vilifying anyone that disagreed meant that only a kind of bumbling, aggressive character that's willing to shake everything up could actually withstand that. But as we've now seen, you know, 5 years plus later, that did not in any way at all really resolve those issues and expose many of the flaws that is well documented that he had. And I think it is very sad that that spirit, that kind of radical democratic spirit, is still needs a vehicle, but the person that many people had put their hopes into has not only failed to deliver, but actually making it much worse.
Yeah, and Tom, arguably, you know, the public were the deplorables back in 2016. Now they're domestic terrorists. Yeah. So the need for a pushback is you know, clearly there.
No, it's gotten more and more extreme, and it's gotten more and more extreme in the wake of the Trump era, not because of him, but because of the reaction to him. You know, the wild overreaction to him. You know, basically this is fascism on the march and so on and so forth. I mean, the whole Joe Biden rhetoric around the MAGA Republicans and domestic terrorism is really that kind of anti-Trumpism on steroids. You know, it's really authoritarian. It's deeply anti-democratic. Often say it's about Trump. You might do some authoritarian, anti-democratic things, but the kind of establishment often, in response to him, sort of show him how it's done. And I think what we're seeing at the moment is a good example of that. FBI agents being sent after parents in the parents movement and all the rest of it is really quite sinister. But as we've been saying, all of that is quite real. And there's so much that happened in the course of the past years, which, yes, was a product of that kind of elite overreaction. But at the same time, there is this sort of fundamental problem with Trump, was that as soon as he got elected, there was his flaws were so brilliantly exposed. There was always a kind of an element that people could kind of project onto him. He was, by dint of being an outsider, he was one of the only people who could sort of see the gap in politics that existed, that he could knock through the orthodoxies of both the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, he would talk about social security and healthcare in a way that upset the sort of Paul Ryan Republican set, whilst also, you know, breaking every kind of speech code of the left and all the rest of it. He sort of cut through in that sense. People liked the fact that he was aggressive and pushing back. But as soon as he gets in power, not only does he get mired in pushing back against all these attempts to topple him, not only does it increasingly become all about him, but there is a sort of sense that beyond building that wall and going after China, he didn't really know what to do with it. And he ended up just filling the gap with a lot of elite Republican sort of slurry, really, which would have been in place regardless of who ended up being president.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the challenge for populists now or radical Democrats is a kind of liberal populism, not one that's just simply, you know, contemptuous of all institutions and very angry and aggressive, whilst there's like very, you know, righteous anger and frustration. I think actually maybe re-articulating kind of populism that still upholds many of the liberal values that we hold dear.
Free speech, especially. Trump was always been a bit of a snowflake. Yeah. Not a fan of democracy, as we...
Exactly.
As we
He's like a Ramona. He likes it when he goes his way.
Yeah.
But,
without,
you know, anything else. But yeah, I mean, you know, we'll always have the laughs, I think, is the main thing to say
definitely.
About
Trump.
The world's greatest tweeter.
And the world's hilarious.
And in a way, he did the world a great service in exposing how deeply anti-democratic the American elite is. But, you know, he was always, to put it very lightly, an imperfect vessel for what was interesting about that election, you know.
Let's move on to talk a bit about the war in Ukraine. It feels like we almost got away with, or we just, there could have been a chance for quite a serious escalation. The newspapers reported things as if there had been an escalation. So when a stray missile hit Poland, we were told that Russia had attacked us. Tom, do you want to tell us a bit about this?
No, this was, I can imagine a lot of people sort of following it quite nervously on social media on Tuesday night, because you saw this sort of one-line report ring out across the place, which was that some US official had briefed someone that a Russian missile had hit Poland about 4 miles from the Ukrainian border, that two people had very tragically died. And suddenly, you know, Twitter was abuzz with all of the... It's a kind of combination of sort of fear, but also kind of excited anticipation that this might finally be the one. I think a lot of that bled into and coloured a lot of the reporting. I mean, some of the front pages, certainly in the UK on the Wednesday morning, were all more or less saying a variation on Russia bombs Poland, Russian missile hits Poland. There was really no pause to try and get some more detail, not least because, as we all know, in the fog of war, who knows really what's going on at any particular point. And yet, since then, we've seen the US, the Polish government, NATO say that what they think has happened here is that this was a Ukrainian missile that was obviously trying to intercept Russian fire that went askew. It's worth pointing out that the Ukrainian government maintains that it wasn't a Ukrainian missile and they want it investigated and so on and so forth. But it's still really pointed to the fact that, you know, there is almost a kind of sense of glee at escalation on the part of the Western media. A lot of very irresponsible reporting, to be frank, and a lack of recognition that whilst, you know, a lot of these people might think in sort of retweets and likes and clicks, the stakes are really quite high here. And do you really want to be in a situation where you're misrepresenting at least what the official line is just because you're desperate to sort of titillate people, really? That's what I think. There was that moment where you just really felt like our media are not really cut out for moments as serious as this.
Yeah, and World War III being the sort of ultimate titillation, the ultimate, you know, wouldn't that be funny type thing.
Yeah, I mean, there does seem to be a really big, you know, crisis of foreign reporting and international reporting, where the nuances and complexities of various different international conflicts are take a secondary priority to the kind of drama that can be retweeted and shared on social media. And I remember a few years ago, we were speaking about Trump just a moment ago, when there was the killing of Soleimani.
Yeah.
And everyone you know, ramped that up very quickly on social media, thinking that that was going to be World War III and everything. Yeah. And loads of people were very panicked. And then that kind of died down very quickly. And actually, that's incredibly serious. It should, is an obvious point to make, but that's such a serious thing claim to make, which can actually massively ramp up tensions, cloud the judgment of people that are actually trying to negotiate and deal with these issues with that kind of pressure. And I think just the reality of conflict, the seriousness of it and what's at stake is increasingly lost in our conversations and discourse about it. And I think that's really dangerous.
We should talk a little bit about you know, where the war is going and some of the good news, particularly the liberation of Kherson, which, you know, caught a lot of people by surprise. Tom, that's a very sort of positive aspect of the Ukrainians fighting back.
No, definitely. It's arguably the most sort of symbolic victory yet, as well as a significant regaining of territory. This was the only regional capital that Russia was maintaining. It was also in a broader region, which had, what was it, about 6-7 weeks ago, was effectively annexed by Russia after these sham referendums. So the level of humiliation is really quite striking. And it seems like even going into the winter, when everyone expected things to slow down, or at least or still expects things to slow down, there's still a hell of a lot of like momentum behind Ukraine's side. And just if you do cast your mind back, even pretty pro-Ukraine people and commentators were not expecting things to pan out like this. You know, it really does pay testament to the determination of this nation to defend itself, of its people really rallying around that particular cause, of very solid leadership, although that's obviously been called into question over the course of the last couple of days in relation to this strike, which we should probably get into briefly. But, you know, if you think about where we started, where it was almost like the complete inverse of what happened in Afghanistan. They thought that had gone for quite some time. It was over, you know, by tea time. Whereas in the case of this, they thought, again, right, we're better off for Zelensky an airlift out because this is only going one way. And yet, what, 9 months later or whatever it is, we're in a situation where they're retaking, you know, swathes of territory. It's really, really quite inspiring.
Yeah, what was it, 48 hours the US intelligence services were giving, you know, until essentially Kyiv fell? When Russia invaded?
Yeah, you know, it is remarkable. And I think, as we've spoken about before, and many people have said, it is a testament to just the extraordinary bravery and courage of you, the Ukrainian people. And that sovereignty is something, you know, worth fighting for and upholding. And I think it is very frustrating when you see some of the discourse on the more extreme ends of the kind of left and right that are always trying to find like an excuse to no longer support Ukraine or to, you know, no longer really believe in their capacity to actually maintain the existence of their society when they are continually proving wrong that when given the necessary support to do so, that they can and will succeed.
And that's really important. And the Afghanistan comparison is really useful because, you know, the Afghan army had it was very tooled up with American weapons.
And now the Taliban.
And now the Taliban has them. But it really, it's not just the weapons. It is about the willingness of those people to fight for their, to fight to reclaim their territory.
We should just quickly about the Zelensky stuff, because that's also, because obviously this particular, you know, the past 48 hours or so have exposed some fault lines between Ukraine and the West, not just on this particular strike, but also there's always been, obviously it's always been something that Zelensky has been pushing for more direct NATO involvement. And for obvious reasons, a lot of people in the West don't see the wisdom of that, of risking broadening the theatre of the war and dragging in other countries of starting World War III. That's always been a tension. But it's interesting. And also there are conflicting reports as to what happened, and we'll find out in the fullness of time what actually did happen on the Polish-Ukrainian border, I'm sure, at some point. But it's interesting. I think the response from certain voices now is purely they're just looking for an excuse to say, well, this was all just a con, wasn't it? Well, he's obviously a bastard, isn't he? And whilst, yes, there is this quite cloying kind of lionization, turning Zelensky into a sort of saint in certain quarters, he's of no political leader is sinner or saint in that. It's not this isn't a simplistic kind of morality play that we're talking about here. There is this desperation and often quite a conspiratorial tendency to wait for the moment to see it was all a con, or see he's just trying to start World War III, or see they should just give up. That's usually the end point of what it is that they're saying. I feel like this particular moment has just drawn all that out. And people present it as skepticism. I think it's just, again, another expression, that sort of cynicism that a lot of people have in relation to Ukraine in this conflict since the beginning, really.
Yeah, just quickly to add to that, I completely agree. And I think it does show that it is unfortunate as well how the rightful skepticism of what happened during the lockdown and a lot of the issues around that, many of those same people have kind of failed to see how different issues require different approaches and thinking. And I do think that there is a danger of that kind of lockdown skepticism being projected onto all issues, which makes us less
some people
able.
Think it's the same issue.
Well, exactly.
It's a continuation of it.
Exactly. And I think we need to be able to differentiate and be able to make judgments on its own terms of these different issues.
So let's talk about something that we would see as unequivocally good news. This week, the UN has declared the day of 8 billion. So in theory, the kind of 8 billionth person on the planet has joined us. So we've smashed through that massive population milestone. Now, Niall, this is obviously good news. It's obviously a sign that despite all the doom and gloom out there, the world is a good place to live, surely.
I mean, it's interesting that when you look at many of the reasons that drive the planet's population to boom, it's, for example, one of them is a reduction in infant mortality, for example. You know, many of the kids that otherwise would have died because of the horrible sanitary conditions or the fact that there wasn't enough food are now surviving because of development. You know, that is surely a positive thing. And oftentimes, actually, in countries, as they develop, as women get more educated, then a lot of those societies then have less children because of people's priorities changing. So oftentimes it increases and then plateaus. And actually what we're seeing in many very developed countries like Japan and Germany and so on, it's actually decreasing. So when you look at it from a broader perspective, it's not really a problem. And actually a lot of the time the planet population levels out, but it really just reveals that many of the attitudes around this is really driven by this vicious anti-humanism that, you know, as we've spoken about many times before, that human beings are the problem and that they are some kind of cancerous force on the planet draining its resources.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a horrible, horrible way to look at people.
But that's a view that's been expressed notably in The Guardian, article tweeted by Caroline Lucas, the Green Party co-leader, you know, saying, why can't we talk about why 8 billion people is a problem? But it's not a problem.
No, it's not a problem. It's fantastic. It's brilliant. More people, the merrier, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, time and time again, humanity has proven those fear-mongers wrong. You know, if you think about how much the population has expanded over what feels like quite a short space of time, really. Yeah. It was like 1900, roughly speaking. It was like 1.8 billion people, or a bit less than that, I think. You know, as of 2011, it was 7 billion people. And, you know, in that short space of time, we've seen even more people added to the sort of teeming masses of the planet. At every step along the way of this, there's been someone saying, we're all about to die. Like, we're about to run out. You know, Paul Ehrlich in the Population Bomb book in 1968. Effectively saying that, you know, there's going to be mass starvation in quite short order.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, over the past 25 years, like more than 1 billion people have been lifted out of poverty. You know, again, development and economic growth, particularly in areas of the world that hadn't yet experienced that kind of thing, has been able to provide for these huge swathes of people. And it's interesting because the environmentalists for a while went a bit quiet about the population control stuff, not least because it has a very unpleasant aspect to it and history. You know, it's also often sees even some of the contemporary environmentalists tumble into something like racism when they start pontificating about there being too many people in Africa and so on and so forth. But it always comes back.
China one child policy.
Exactly. Like Attenborough, I think, had qualified praise at one point for the one child policy, which tells you everything you need to know. But they kind of go quiet about it. And they tend to kind of say, well, the problem really is consumption. It's the people at the top who are consuming so much, as if the people who are just lifting themselves out of extreme poverty shouldn't enjoy a nice life. It doesn't really add up. But they have kept quiet about it. But what I thought was interesting about that Guardian article doing the rounds was that at the bottom, this is what they believe. You know, surely more people, more consumption, more of those evil carbon emissions, and therefore we're all going to hell in a handcart. So that anti-humanism, that misanthropy is always there. They've just kept quiet about it for a while. But of course, this is what they think, because they do primarily see humanity, as you were saying, Anaya, as a drain, as a problem.
Yeah.
Or they'll call it overconsumption. Overconsumption is the problem, not overpopulation. Mm. But then what's the right level of consumption? How poor should someone stay, and who's going to force them to be that poor?
Yeah, it is completely illogical. But I mean, but it also is just factually doesn't really stack up. I mean, it seems, if you look at the trends in a lot of Western countries, that the problem is going to be too few people, not too many. Actually, that, you know, when it comes to reproducing, you know, the workforce and actually productive population, that it's actually decreasing. And so I think that on all of their own terms, that they're wrong.
Well, they're usually wrong about everything. That's a regular theme on this show. Have you signed up to become a Spiked supporter yet? Spiked Supporters is our thriving donor community. And if you're a Spiked supporter, you can get access to a whole range of extra perks. And I've got an incredibly special one I want to tell you about. On Monday, the 19th of December at 7 p.m. London time, we have the brilliant Toby Young joining Brendan O'Neill for a special live recording of The Brendan O'Neill Show. And it's exclusive to Spiked supporters. You'll be able to watch the recording online. Plus, we'll also be taking audience questions. So if you're already a Spiked supporter, why not claim your free ticket now via the Spiked Supporters Hub? If you're not a Spiked supporter yet, then now is the time to sign up. For as little as £5 or more per month, you can become a Spiked supporter. Then you can sign up to this free event. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up now. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. See you there. So finally, let's turn to Nicola Sturgeon's kind of, I think it's fair to call it a crusade. Mm. She's probably the most vociferous trans activist north of the border. She doesn't seem to be bothered that her kind of policy, her self-ID policy, is wildly unpopular, and yet she's pressing on. It's provoked the largest backbench rebellion in the history of this SNP Scottish government, and yet she persists.
Yeah, I mean, it just seemed like, you know, Nicola Sturgeon's SNP just uses Scotland as a kind of test case for petty authoritarianism. I mean, when you have the, you know, the Scottish Hate Crime Bill, and there was previously the law that was revoked where every child had their own, you know, person.
Name person.
Yeah, the name yeah, person.
Every person, state guardian.
Exactly.
The most very creepy.
Paternalistic policy you could really think of. And now you've got the all of the issues around gender and gender self-identification. And I think it is great, though, in another way, to see how many people in Scotland have really seen this issue as an issue that is at the top of the political agenda and pushed back against it. But the implications are huge, you know, whether that's in prisons, whether that's in refuges, and even some of these stories that have come out about the complete skewing of statistics in relation to patterns of criminal behaviour and so on. And all of this evidence that has been presented has been just utterly dismissed and ignored. It's deeply anti-democratic. I do think it is misogynistic, and I don't use that word lightly. And I think it's very sad.
Yes, Sturgeon said the critics, or the criticism of the policy, are not valid, was her way of brushing it off.
And it's interesting that she can continue on in the face of so much opposition. Mm. This gender recognition reform bill, which is going through, as you say, according to the opinion polls, not just like a slim majority, but a pretty solid majority of all voters oppose every bit of it, or every major bit of it, I should say. Mm. And it is, you know, if you think about what it's ushering in, particularly because to the extent that it contrasts with England, it's really quite drastic. I mean, you're talking about anyone over the age of 16, or they don't need any medical diagnosis of gender dysphoria in order to change their gender. They don't have to live in their chosen gender, if that's the right phrase, for 2 years. It can just be 3 months. Mm. Interesting, some of the debate this week was going on in this committee meeting where a feminist wearing the suffragette colours was ejected at one particular point. That was about whether or not younger people, whether or not they should bump that up to 6 months. Wow. And you thought, this is really quite significant. Part of the debate was also about the fact that someone raised the question about, well, what if someone on the sex offenders register wants to do this? Yeah. And they were like, well, we'll look at that. You know, the level of unthinkingness, I think, is quite striking. And I don't mean to suggest that, you know, as you say, it has a kind of zeal and a crusade-like to it. People must really deeply believe in it. But you do wonder with some of this stuff whether or not they have actually thought about it, whether they have actually even for a second entertained the contrary opinion. Because it's one of those areas in which someone like Nicola Sturgeon, who likes to present herself and kind of Scotland as the sort of, again, the such a much better moral alternative to the rest of rotten Britain and England in particular, that there is an element about embracing this stuff as a giant virtue signal without actually trying to think about the implications. Because as soon as you start thinking about the implications for women's sex-based rights, for the treatment of children, for the potential to really confuse and mess up a lot of young people who might just be gay or might be autistic, all these things which have been very well documented as being a big crossover gender dysphoria. No, it's not valid.
Yeah.
You're all bigots, shut up.
Yeah.
And the fact that that can still carry on in the face of the level of public dissatisfaction as well as dissatisfaction with her own party, I think is really quite striking. But it's the unthinkingness of it that I find so striking. But you do, it does just feel like it's part of that SNP mission to try and differentiate themselves morally from the rest of the UK or England, really.
Yeah.
But that's leading them down, once again, a very, very dark alleyway.
Yeah, I mean, and this is really at a time, I mean, there's still so much more work to be done on it, but this is at a time where we are seeing the rise of, you know, detransitioners, you know, many young people that are taking the NHS and even the government in other countries to court for not actually asking them questions as to why they put them on a pathway to irreversible, in many cases, medical treatment. And the whole affirmation model, which, you know, is morally objectionable in many ways, is being questioned. And even the New York Times, many people have brought to its attention the fact that for the first time, it has actually been exploring whether or not there is significant harm, even though we all know that there is potential for harm around puberty blockers. So it just seems, as Tom said, to very much be driven by, to be seen as virtuous, even if it's leaving such a huge damage in the wake of that.
Yeah.
And Neil Davenport made this point in an article on Spike this week, which I thought really nailed it, which was the fact that it's interesting how, particularly to take someone like Scotland, you mentioned the named person scheme, you know, this kind of quite authoritarian pursuit of child protection to the point where you're talking about assigning a state guardian to every child. And yet when it comes to something like the trans issue, child protection associates, you'd throw it under the bus. It doesn't matter. Put them on these irreversible drugs. Do it.
Yeah.
We're good people. Don't think about it. Go. Don't ask questions. It just really gives the lie to this idea that this is really a kind of caring ideology, whatever it is, the thing that we're dealing with. This desperation to sort of look good rather than actually do good is at the root of a lot of problems, I think, that we're facing, not just in Scotland, but in the rest of the country at the moment.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We're back every Friday and you can now watch us on video too. Check us out on YouTube or go via the Spiked website, which is spiked-online.com. See you next time.